Welcome to Hallo Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. The creator of the heavens and earth speaks through unexpected channels, including using pagan Egyptian mythology, to reveal his plan. Discover how Joseph's unwavering faith transforms him from a forgotten slave to Egypt's savior. This demonstrates that trusting Adonai, the Lord, transcends circumstances. The dreams of Pharaoh in Genesis 41 reveal more than just agricultural prophecy. They showcase God's ability to communicate across cultural boundaries, preparing the way for his redemptive purpose, fulfilled through Messiah Yeshua, also known as Christ Jesus. Joseph's journey reminds us that faithfulness opens doors no human can close.
Most of us have dreams. May not remember them all, but we do have dreams. We dream about something at nighttime, whatever our dream may be, from it's a learning process, how we learn through our day. The majority of our dreams, mine, at least for me, I don't know if the rest of you, but for me it is, I don't tend to remember all the details about them. Some of you might, but I don't, unless it's like super, like semi-awake, semi-not, I might remember more details, but most dreams I don't remember all the details about. And that's pretty typical, I think, for majority of people. And so when you have a dream, if, even if you do remember the dream or remember most of the details about the dream, do you immediately assume or associate God sent me a message? For most of us, we dismiss it. Yeah, Isaac, you also put it out, no, some of my dreams are crazy. God's me that, he's crazy. It doesn't really work. Right, because some of the dreams are a little bizarre. They're just random junk that floats through my heads and our that's actually how our brain learns stuff. Yeah, some are from insecurities, as what Lorianne pointed out. Some of you have their dreams about different things, such as your day, your life, that type of thing. Well, what I'll bring your attention to is at some point, for certain individuals, in this case, obviously we have Pharaoh, it happens other people too along in our Bible, that they retain their dream and think it's really important, right? They learn something about the dream, or they think there's some message inside this dream. And we have our different ways of determining what that might be, meaning interpret the message or interpret whether it is a message or not. Those two different decisions being made. But what we're bringing your attention to is that in Pharaoh's dreams, he has obviously, well, it says, it describes two separate dreams, the cows and then the grain. But Pharaoh in verse 7 realizes this is one dream. He knows it's one dream. So he's not like it's shocked that Joseph explained it was one dream. He realized it was one dream. He just couldn't understand it. But for some reason, Pharaoh, in this instance, thought this dream, as opposed to whatever, maybe he ate something bad that night for dinner, this dream was real. There's something important about this dream. And I want to bring to our attention in that it is a Judeo-Christian tradition to interpret the dream elements and parts of those dreams based on our perspective, what we see, how we interpret them, our world, what we think cows mean or what grain is, that kind of thing. Well, let's remember that the dream wasn't given to a Judeo-Christian person, was it? Who was the dream given to? It was given to Pharaoh. Well, as you know, Pharaoh was not a worshiper of our God. He didn't worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He worshiped his own pantheon of gods. And so I find this is what I'll bring up today a little bit. I find this part interesting is that God, which we'll go through some of these dreams in greater detail than I traditionally go through them because we have time to do that. God is utilizing actually the pagan viewpoint inside the dream given to Pharaoh. And I find that fascinating because we don't typically understand or look at as Christians or as Jews, look at, or even Muslims for that matter, look at the actual pagan symbols being used inside of this dream. We typically interpret them from the biblical perspective, which is the biblical perspective, meaning what Joseph explains is correct. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. It's that something triggered inside Pharaoh's mind. This was not just a random dream. This means something to me. We can say, oh, well, God inspired him. Sure, we can say that. But then that's fine. I don't buy that. And that Pharaoh, I know, is a pagan belief system. He has a pantheon of gods. There's roughly 2,000-ish gods of Egyptian mythology. And they progress or grew more than produced as the time went on. But in Pharaoh's time period, this dream from the pagan gods he would have worshipped, which is the pagan gods of the late Middle Kingdom, early New Kingdom period, which is where he's living at this time, roughly 1650 or 1700 or so BC. This time period, he's living then or thereabouts, maybe not exact, could be 60. It's that 100-year span, give or take. I don't know the exact dates of Joseph or this particular pharaoh. But either way, in this time period which they're reading and we're reading about them, they worship specific set of gods. And those gods mean something to them. So we're going to draw a little bit about them to understand what they mean, to why Pharaoh would say, oh no, this is a super important dream, something major is going on, and why his wise men could not interpret the dream because they have their pagan theology and what they're trying to understand based on pagan theology. And this may seem unimportant to us, but the reason I'm bringing it up too is because our Bible does it more than one time. This is not the only time our Bible uses, or God uses, I should say, pagan theology or pagan mythology in an interpretive dream, because it depends on who he's talking to. It tells us our God is a lot smarter than we give him credit for sometimes. He's able to talk to people where they're at, not necessarily where they should be, which is really important to understand. God, it's a huge thing. God can talk to you where you're at, and not wait or require or demand you to reach to him first. That's an important concept to understand as Christians, as Jews, as anyone who believes the Judeo-Christian God, that he doesn't require us to walk to him a minimum distance before he can talk to us. He can talk to us anywhere, because we're technically all his kids. And so understand what this means and how this looks. I'm going to draw a few detailed pictures for you on the pagan theology of what Pharaoh's dreams are. So first of all, his first dream, of course, involves seven cows. Now, mind you, I'm not the world's best artist. Smart is probably better than I am, but she's not up here, so I am. So I don't have a good final graph with these diagrams. Final graph is terrible in this application. So, because it doesn't do pantheon of gods. Anyway, so in Pharaoh's dream, so dream number one, he has, obviously we have the seven good cows, but we start out not with cows, we start up with the river. So I'm going to draw, I don't have blue. But so draw, you know, we'll do roughly a river. You know, there's a river here. There's land on this side, trees, and there's land on this side of the river. We'll put like little twigs, bushes, whatnot. So pretend this is my river. So, okay, don't look at me. It's close enough, all right? He's a critic. If you can find blue ones, it'd be great. Anyway, so it starts out that Pharaoh is standing over the river. So I'm putting a little stick figure of Pharaoh up. It's off my page. We'll go up here, a little down, a little lower. Stick figure of Pharaoh. We'll give him a little staff because he's Pharaoh with a little goatee. A snake thing. I don't do the snake thing. Whatever. It's Pharaoh. Okay, pretend he's Pharaoh. Forgive me for what is it? My artist. But this is the start of our pagan Egyptian theology. This we understand first, before we can understand the cows, understand what this start out means. Oh, thank you, Joseph, for the different colors. So in this case, we start out with this Pharaoh's standing over the river. Now we have to understand what this means in pagan Egyptian theology. So the case of Pharaoh, so the man himself, I'll put in blue over here, because I have blue. The man himself, he is the descendant of three people, all right? I know it sounds strange, but it's three. There is his biological dad, his biological mom, and his god, Ra. So every pharaoh is... Oh, I'm off the page already. I'll move my camera up a little bit. Every pharaoh has always been this. It doesn't matter whether or not it's the beginning of Egyptian history or the very last pharaoh that ever existed. They all have the exact same genealogy. They have a mom, they have a dad, and Ra is their god, is their dad. So they have, that's disgusting, Lorianne. Threesome. Anyway, this is how this process works. So the mother and father are the biological children, biological parents. However, every mom, while she's still, this is Egyptian mythology, theology, every mother who's ever had a pharaoh's child, it doesn't matter if the pharaoh's male or female, by the way, this is universal. Ra, the sun god, mates with the mother after the child's impregnated. So the child, or after the mother's pregnant, she's pregnant with the baby, he comes and mates with the mother, on a spiritual level, distributing a small part of his spirit into the child. Now, by the rules of Egyptian theology, This child is now, because of this spiritual impregnation on the spirit side of the child, this child is now defined as the son. Oops, backwards. Son of Ra. Even though he has a biological dad, we don't care about that one. The son of Ra is what he's called. And in Egyptian mythology and theological viewpoint, the Pharaoh is required to call Ra the father. He's not allowed to call his own dad a father. He is called Ra the father. This is how this process works. I know it sounds strange, but we're understanding this. And the reason why we're studying this is because the son of Ra has one responsibility as the son of Ra, all right, as being Pharaoh. His job is to make sure the cosmic order is sustained. That means all the stars and suns and the planets run. He also makes sure the river doesn't run dry, which refers to River Nile. So in this mythology, this pharaoh, every pharaoh, male or female, makes no difference, are all this, they required, once this happens, assuming the dad eventually dies, because every pharaoh dies eventually, the son comes over and he comes back over here. He now becomes in charge of the Nile. So everything related to Nile is his responsibility. Whether it rains, whether it floods, whether it's a drought, it's all his job to fix it. That's what it's ruled. That's how the rule works. If you fail to do that, you're no longer observing the son of Ra status. Now, in Egyptian mythology, this is important to understand too, because it also plays later on in the book of Revelation, which we'll discuss in chapter 7 in a few minutes, or a little longer, a few minutes, but a little while from now, is that in this job, if the son of Ra fails to do this task, the spirit part that Ra mated with his mother with and mixed in the spirit does not return to heaven when the son dies. That's an important mythology process. So we've seen, for example, pyramids, right? The big pyramids, they have these big pyramids out there. You got a bunch of dead people buried inside of them. There's these little funky shafts and all things inside the pyramid and these different tools and whatever else you got in this pyramid. They also have the Tomb of the Kings, the same thing. The idea is that the spirit of this pharaoh, once he died, or she, because it'll be she too, died, they have to find their way back to heaven where Ra lives, the sun god. And so they have this is the core belief system from early Egyptian history all the way through to later New Kingdom before Egypt actually falls out of the Pharaoh belief system. Now, I'm bringing this up because this dream's important. If Pharaoh dreams he's above the river, he's thinking in his mind, as all the pharaohs would have thought, oh, I have a message from Ra, my dad, because this is the only responsibility my dad Ra gave me. Watch this river. All right? So now we have Egyptian mythology understanding it. Now Pharaoh understands, I have this vision, I'm over the river. Oh, this is my position. Dad, Ra, what do you want me to know? What message have you given to me? What are you trying to tell me about this job? That's where our vision starts. And this is why one of the core belief systems of Egyptian mythology, why this would be a super, super important dream to Pharaoh in his pagan theology, because this is a message from Ra as far as he understands, because that's his only job. So in this message from Ra, I'm going to erase some of this. I'll leave that part up. I'll just draw down here with new color. And the message from Ra, as far as he thinks it's for Ra, of course, is that you have these seven cows. Okay, my cows aren't great, but they come out of the river. So the cows come out of the river. That's an important part. Cows come, they don't just pop up on the land like the grain does. They say river cow. Brown. Oh, brown. I can do brown. She wants a brown color. Brown cow. Well, I don't have a brown. I have this like a magenta color. Whatever. It is. So I'll draw these cows. I'll draw them in the river to make my life easier, because it's easier to explain. So I have these cows, moo cow with a tail. All right. Yes, they all can laugh at me. Okay, you don't laugh that hard. Okay, it's moo cows. That's four. Two more, three over here. They're nice and fat. Okay, sheep, cow, whatever. Same thing. Okay. It's an animal. So I have these seven cows, a big, fat, and plump. Now here is our second Egyptian mythology figure, all right? A cow. We think of in traditional Judeo-Christian interpretation, they've interpreted these cows in most of the books I've read about this, which is really frustrating to me, but it's okay. They interpret the cow as, oh, it's plowing because you plow with the cattle, right? No, you plow with ox, or you plow with a male, a bull. You plow with it. You don't plow with female cows. Who would do that? No one would do that. Okay. Because they're really ornery to work with when it comes to females. So I've read a book about that. They actually do not work well with plowing, because in Egyptian mythology, this has nothing to do with plowing. This plowing is a last thing on this imagery or this thought process. It has nothing to do with plowing at all in Egyptian mythology. What was that? Why would Pharaoh's mind? Why? Oh, so he's thinking in Pharaoh's mind, why would Ra talk about plowing? Actually, we'll talk about that in a minute, because another god who does the crops. We'll talk about him shortly, because that's the second dream. Instead, what we actually learn about this is the fat, plump female cow is Ra's mother. That's her symbol. So Ra's mom is symboled. I buy the big, fat, plump cow. Moo. Okay. Four legs. Big, fat, plump cow. And so that is her symbol. So Ra is giving him a message about his mom. Now, to be fair, the cow is also a symbol of Ra's girlfriend / female consorts. But the cow, the mom, is the most common one in Egyptian mythology. Okay, Egyptians were crazy, to be fair. They were crazy. That's how it is. Anyway, so in Egyptian mythology, because this is how they're going to think, the pharaoh is thinking, oh no, there's a message about Ra's mother. And the message is she's going to be eaten up by 7 scrawny cows. Oh, this one's marker is dry. She has 7 scrawny cows. I'll put them straight back because there's no tummy to them. They're going to be eaten up. 7. Okay. This looks like a funky Greek pie. I know. I come on, bear with me, guys. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I look like a Greek pie, doesn't it? Well, with a handle on it. Okay, so the 7 scrawny cows also are going to eat these. Now, this would be alarming to an Egyptian theologist. They say, oh no, because they don't have a god of the skinny cow. Okay, this is not they've got a fat cow. So something bad is going to consume or eat up Ra's mother. This is their theology. And we think to ourselves, and now if you were in Pharaoh's shoes and you saw this, try to explain this to your wise men who are masters in Egyptian mythology, what would they say? A bunch of something bad's going to happen to Ra's mom, and it's your responsibility to fix it, Pharaoh. And you look at them, are you nuts? What am I supposed to do? This is crazy. Me as Pharaoh, how could I? What am I supposed to do? And they wouldn't have a message, wouldn't have an answer for it. I'm bringing this up. The reason I'm bringing this whole Egyptian mythology up is because we're exploring a little bit on the wisdom and lack thereof, and when God shuts wisdom off versus when he turns it on to somebody. This is why we're talking about this mythology. So this is one of the reasons why we're learning about our God in this bizarre mythology going on in Egyptian mythology. So this is dream number one, and he, as a charged river, the king of the river, is responsible to fix it. But in the first dream, there is no instruction on what to do, right? It's missing the answer. So here you have a dream, a message, but what would you do about it? And what does number 7 mean in Egyptian mythology? Honestly, that I didn't look up, so I'd have to check that again. I don't remember. But I do know that these are the symbols being discussed. So he has this mythology, and this is his message. His second dream, which is obviously the Bible describes as like the first, has a very similar but a different responsibility as far as which gods are fighting what. So right now it appears in this first dream, we have some unknown skinny cow god is about to attack and consume and kill Ra's mother, or some argue his girlfriend. I think it's still his mother because she's the most common one associated with the big fat cow. Anyway, so that's how, and he, as in charge of the river, is responsible to fix it. He has to do something about it. Next image, next dream. So next dream does not contain the river. Erase this part. We'll leave. Do we need that up? We'll erase the cow part because that's not important on this part. But the raw remains in a minute. So the next dream we have the grain, right? Change colors here, black to blue. We have, now there's no river in this second dream. This just grain. He's always seeing grain. So we have 7 stalks of grain, 4, 5, 6, 7. We'll put little ears. There's lots of ears of fat plump grain. Is it seven stalks or seven? Is it one with seven grains in it? I remember. It doesn't matter. The point is there's seven, there's grains. Okay. My grains are terrible, but I'm in a hurry. All right. So he has these stalks. I think it's just one stalk with 7 ears. I have to double check. It's one stalk with 7 ears. Okay. So one stalk with 7 ears. That's what I thought. Something seemed off on that picture. So one stalk with 7 ears. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. Big fat grain. It's on the ground or whatever. It doesn't have to describe where it's coming out of. And then he has this skinny one with these skinny stalks, almost of no real value. And they consume up the big fat plump ones. Yes. No, but there is a God of the grain. And so this is an important one. This imagery here in Egyptian mythology. So it describes this skinny grain as scorched by the east wind. That's its descriptive matter. Well, guess what? Yes, there's a god of wind. So Amun, I gotta get rid of that marker. Amun is a god of wind. Now, Amun, as well as Ra, they later on get blended to the same god called Amun-Ra. No, it's just a wind of wind. So Amun appears to have scorched this particular grain in Egyptian mythology. And this grain has consumed the good grain. It appears then in Egyptian mythology, according to the wise men of Pharaoh, that Amun must be very angry. All right? Because he's scorching the wind. He's scorching, that's his job. He is the wind scorcher. That's his job. All the sort of wind and air. Now, Amun seems to be doing this according to Egyptian mythology. Now, on top of that, what is he attacking? He's attacking grain. He's drying the grain now. Well, grain is also a god named Nippur. Oh, crap. Change grains. Yeah, Apir, not Pir. N-E-P-E-R, Nippur. He is the grain god. So it appears in this second dream, which Pharaoh realizes is somehow related to the cow thing, is that Amun and Nippur are at war or upset with each other somehow, that Amun is attacking Nippur and attacking all the grain. These are all the early Egyptian gods. Middle Kingdom Egyptian gods. Right. So Nippur's in charge of the fat grain, but he's being attacked or destroyed by Amun. So this, if I went to my Greek mythology, or sorry, Greek, I keep doing that, Egyptian mythology wise men, asked them, what do these dreams mean? I'm going to have a crazy explanation, aren't I? Right? Just crazy. I got gods fighting against gods. Amun apparently is responsible for part of it. But Amun responsible for the skinny cows. It gets insane to try to explain, doesn't it? You can't figure it out. It's bizarre. But because it's using all the symbols that Pharaoh worships and is responsible for, and all the Egyptian belief system is geared toward these particular gods, these are some of the top gods they have in their mythology at this Middle Kingdom time period. Not the only ones, they have a few others, but these are the top ones. This would be a very alarming to Pharaoh, wouldn't it? Right? That something important is happening. The gods are telling me something. Ra is giving a message and I don't know what to do about it. I can't understand it. Because if I was Pharaoh's shoes, charge the river, how would I stop a moon from attacking the pier? It wouldn't work. I can't stop the wind. Try to rope the wind. Good luck with that, right? Throw water at the wind, see if it stops. Yeah. So because of this mythology, the god utilized all of the most important components of Pharaoh's theological viewpoint. This gives Pharaoh a trigger. This isn't just an ordinary dream, right? This isn't just I ate pizza for dinner last night and I didn't drink enough water tonight. Well, it wasn't like a bad, I'm joking, I didn't have pizza. As an example, I didn't eat something bad because I'm using all the symbols that Pharaoh is responsible to take care of, okay? Because that river, that Na River, is also the water source for grain, too, in Egypt. So it all is based the same principle. Now, our God reutilized at least the river example in Book of Revelation, because, what's that? Is the God of the skinny cows. Right, no, not our God. So he's asked, is the God of the skinny cows, the wizard grain, is that supposed to be like our God? No. We're not assigning our God to any of these things. This is just Egyptian mythology to understand how important it is for the Egyptian Pharaoh to solve this problem, as opposed to dismiss it by just a random dream, right? Right. Right. If he didn't pay attention to the dream, he might get lost in what he's supposed to do about it. Because all the different people, all of those different smart, wise men could not understand or interpret the dream correctly or fairly to his satisfaction. So it's important to understand why a dream would become go from just a random dream to something important. Now, Pharaoh is a pagan belief system. He has a pagan mythology belief system, not the Judeo-Christian God system idea. So God, our God, could have simply come to Pharaoh and said, "Hey, Pharaoh, I'm going to wreck your kingdom for 7 years. After the first seven, it's all fighting great and wonderful." He could have said that, right? Mission accomplished, moving on. But God didn't do that. He used the pagan symbols in Egypt they worshipped to understand what was happening, so they could understand this is a really important thing. I need to find the solution. What is this? And make them essentially be scared or startle them to this near panic type of scenario. So I know it's a lot of stuff about Egyptian mythology, but it's relatively important of what's happening inside this storyline, because that's what God is using to explain it. Now, Pharaoh, as I mentioned before in verse 7, realizes this is one dream. So this is one story being taught to him or told to him through two different dreams. Joseph regurgitates the exact same thing. So, hey, it's one message from two different dream sources, but it's one message alone. Now, since the Egyptian theology experts would struggle with all that stuff I just explained to you as far as what the dream would look like to them, they would have a very difficult time explaining it, because this one core fundamental point, this is what would trip them all up. Tammy, you have a question? Go ahead, dear.
Fear is a greater motivator than common sense.
Yeah, it does work that way pretty well. fear will scare you. So if it's designed to scare them, because there's something very, very scary here is happening. We don't know what it is, but it's a very scary thing, and they can't explain it. So for example, I give you this dream, all right? I give you this Egyptian mythology explanation for it, of what these all things mean. But what's Pharaoh supposed to do about it, right? If he's had this dream, all right, you're responsible, you have this river, this is your job, Pharaoh. Now here's the problem. And then I say, go fix it. How does a Pharaoh, whether he believes he's Ra's biological son or not, doesn't make a difference. How does a man or even a team of men fix this problem? Because as far as he's concerned, these are gods fighting. How do you fight against gods? They're not like people. You don't beat them up or arrest them. You can't stop the wind. You can't make fat cow or skinny cows get fat all of a sudden. It doesn't. They are what they are. What does this do? And so even though an interpretation from the Egyptian wise men may be understandable, though to me it's difficult to understand this, but bear with me. Let's assume they could understand all the stuff I just put up here on the board, because Egyptians have a different mindset, which we'll talk about some other time. Even understand that the symbols, it doesn't give you the answer what to do. That's the problem. So even if they could explain all the symbols, they don't have an answer. When he says, "Great, you told us stuff. What do I do about it?" And you hear crickets, cricket, cricket, cricket. There's nothing there. Dead silence, because no one knows. You couldn't fix it. It's not a fixable thing. So they know it's a fearful thing. Something bad's happening, but we don't know what to do. So their interpretation was not going to be good enough for Pharaoh in any means. So even if they give any elaborate description as to what's happening, it's not sufficient enough. And this is where I think God is playing, I should say playing, utilizing on a semi-whimsical manner, bringing to recollection the dream that the wine bearer held or had in Joseph. So this elaborate Egyptian mythology thing that the Egyptian mythologies couldn't figure out, Egyptian experts in mythology could not figure out. The wine cup guy says, "Hey, there's this dude down in the prison that he's from the butcher's prison down there. He's a Hebrew, which means he's wrong religion. Strike number one. He's a youth. He says no wisdom behind him. Strike number two. And what else he described? He's a youth, a religion. And he's a slave. Right. Strike number three. In Egyptian law, slaves are not allowed to own or control anything in Egypt ever their entire lives. If you were a slave the day you were born and you became not a slave the following day, doesn't matter, you can own nothing. You have zero property rights because you were born as a slave, you must stay as a slave. So Yeah, I know, but he became a slave at any point in time in your life. You become a slave at any point in time in your life, you become a slave, you are not permitted to control or run anything, period. Well, yeah, work without pay. So definition of slave in Egyptian history, I don't remember, it changed over times. It was mostly they own you. So you do whatever they tell you to do, whether they pay you or not, it's kind of debatable. Anyway, they pay you food. Does that count? So he has these three strikes against him. He's a slave, he's a youth, and he's a Hebrew. So wrong religion, too young to have youth. He's like 30 years old. That his definition of youth is different than mine. 30-year-old man, but he still calls him a youth, and he's a slave. All three major strikes against him. And so he would not have any of the theological background or knowledge any of the wise men of Pharaoh have. Nothing. He's got a totally wrong religion, totally wrong everything against him. He's worthless. But the guy said, this worthless guy over here in prison, yeah, that dude over there that you don't know about him yet, he interprets dreams correctly. Light bulbs go off. What? What? This guy that's the wrong religion can interpret a dream correctly? I want to talk to him. So I find this more whimsical or more funny than some may, as far as his belief system, and it comes to trying to find out, well, trying to get Joseph out of this scenario. God have his son play with faithful. Yeah. And it comes to pagans. I think he does have a little fun with it sometimes. In my opinion, that's just my opinion. But I do find it fascinating that God still uses pagan mythology to talk to pagan people. We have a great example with Nebuchadnezzar. There's a lot of it there. So God does use, he's not opposed to using our idiocy against us, right? And having fun while he's at it. Yeah, he does do that too. So instead of using words, he uses that. So all these different strikes against Joseph, obviously he becomes out of prison. So I want to bring this up to you. In the story of Joseph coming out of the prison, essentially Joseph is receiving, for lack of a better term, a type of, you know, salvation. I know I don't throw that word around too often, but the idea is that he's in prison, he has nothing. All right, he's kind of in charge. We use the term loosely. He's still a prisoner. He's still in charge of prison, but he's still a prisoner. He has nothing. So God pulls him out after all these years. He's like 30 years old or thereabouts when he's pulled out. And so he's pulled out of prison, and it comes very quickly. So as far as Joseph's concerned, hey, I helped these two guys. Well, didn't help the baker. He died, but he probably wasn't in a good mood. But anyway, so the baker died. But the cupbearer was, hey, good things. Yeah, great, wonderful. But as time went on, the guy forgot him. So I'm going to bring this up to us in our understanding here. When God's timing occurs to Joseph, for example, let's pretend you were Joseph. All right. You've been in this prison for years now. You've been in Egypt. You have no rights. You're a slave. You have no value to anyone except the guy who you help with in charge of the prison. The warden, right? The warden's the only guy you actually have any use, who thinks you're any useful at all in any capacity. So you're in this storyline. You tried to help out some guys. You tried to get out of prison. It didn't work. Time went on. The cupbearer forgot you because you're a nobody. You're not important. So in your hopeless despair, this moment in time which you're down in prison, no one cares about you. Your family's gone, right? Right? Does he know what his brothers? They're back in somewhere else. He has no idea if they're even alive anymore. They aren't coming to look for him. His dad's not coming to look for him. His former owners aren't looking for him. Nobody wants him. He's of no value to anyone. It's a very depressing place to be, isn't it? To where no one cares about you. If you live or die, all you're going to be is some guy's, you know, half hour work to dump your body somewhere. That's all your value is, the half hour work to dump your dead body. So it's pretty low place. But when God decides to get you out, the day before you were depressed, now you're not. Instantaneous elevation to the essentially just about the highest position in the land pretty quickly. And I ask this question because it's kind of important to me, is that Joseph's faith, that he went through all these difficult struggles in life, that would try, I think, just about everybody. Most of us would go through those, we'd say, God, you've forgotten about me. You don't care anymore. Most of us. I'm not saying everybody, but most of this is above average faith this guy has. Yeah, I mean, most people are not that faithful. I understand that. And so God doesn't put us through certain things that we probably wouldn't make it. So the point being is that this faith base that Joseph has gotten him through things that most of us would fail at. Not everybody, and not fail at every scenario, but at least overall, the majority of people would probably fail at this. But that's the nature of being a prophet. So Joseph is a prophet. Now, granted, we could debate how much he prophesies. He does obviously some in his storyline. We don't know all the stuff he did in his lifetime. But he is a prophet to at least to Pharaoh, and of course, obviously to his brothers with the dreams that he had, and to his dad. So he is a prophet. And the nature of a prophet, unlike the wise men who are trying to explain to Pharaoh his bizarre dreams and their weird mythology, the prophet's job is not just to tell you what you're seeing, but tell you what it means. Right? What does your life mean? What's the direction it's going to? Where is we headed? What does the future look like? Not what is, but what should I do about the future? Can I influence in a positive, or in some cases negative, way of the future? That's a prophet's job. It's not to make you money. It's to make you, as far as do the right thing of what is right versus what is wrong. And I bring this up because based on biblical examples, the messages given to the leaders of different nations, they're directed to that leader. So let me explain this a little bit, what I mean by this. So let's pretend you lived in Egypt, but you were not Pharaoh. Okay. You were just an ordinary schmo living in Egypt, all right? At the time this whole event took place. And God sends you, the ordinary schmo, this dream. It doesn't to Pharaoh, but says just to you. Now, you're just an ordinary guy. Maybe you're a farmer, or maybe you're a guard that watches the outhouse. Whatever you're doing, right? That's your job. Make sure you don't fall down to the outhouse hole. You know what's that? So maybe that's your only task, all right? That's all your job is. If you receive that dream, are you going to say, oh, quick, let's go to the prophets and save Egypt? I've been hanging out house too long. I need to change jobs. The schemes are getting to me. So because God's going to send a message to the persons who can do something about it. Does that make sense? It's of no value for God to send a dream to some schmo who can't do dilly squat about it. It's useless. However, sending a dream to a leader of a nation or an organization or in charge of something or a family head of a household, that can be done, something can be done about those. They're useful. So if God's going to send a message, you're going to send it straight to his prophets only and leave it at that? No. Our Bible discussed that many times. The prophet's job is to go tell everybody else what's going on, right? Or God sends a message to the leader themselves. The leader, talk to the leader themselves. Now, because obviously the primary example, King David did a few times. We obviously have Pharaoh as another example. God talks to them directly because they have the power to do something. So you are now no longer the Egyptian schmo. Let's put you in the Pharaoh's position and you receive these dreams. You have the responsibility to fix it, do something about it. You don't know what yet, but you just think about it, right? Now you have the power to do it, but now you have the answer of what to do. Now you can interpret off your own ideas, what you think that dream looks like, what you think the answer is, or you consult with people, right? Which Pharaoh did, consult with people. People you think or trust are wise. Now, if somebody comes along to you who is a slave and a nobody and says, hey, all those guys are nuts, listen to me instead. You as a leader instinctively would say, go away or off your head, whatever it may be. I don't need you anymore. Dismiss, go sweep the floors. You're useless to me right now. So if Joseph just came to Pharaoh without being the history behind, hey, I've successfully interpreted dreams, so to speak, in the case of the cupbearer, Pharaoh would have no use for him to listen to his interpretation. But God playing with this, using Pharaoh's paganology belief system against him, so to speak, against his wise men, then gets to introduce somebody who does know who God is. So God's objective, even though he used pagan mythology to teach it, he still utilized the learning opportunity about, hey, this is the God you don't know about. There's one stronger than you that you should pay attention to or listen to. We have a similar account or similar description by the Apostle Paul, of course, in the book of Acts regarding Mars Hill, the unknown God. He explains that, hey, all you people of Athens, as Apostle Paul discussed in Acts 17, all people of Athens are very religious people. You have all these gods of everything, this, that, and whatever else you can think of. And Paul says, hey, there's one over here that says an unknown God, and we'll talk to you about this guy. And so Paul is able to introduce to them more details about a God they didn't know. That's the learning ability and the value of what a message or a messenger from God has, whether it be an apostle or be a prophet or a teacher, whatever it may be, or even an ordinary person on the street. If you have the ability to explain a message and God can teach the individual who's wherever they at in their walk, whether they are pagan worshiping Pharaoh or even a homeless drug addict, makes a difference. God can work with you where you're at and start walking you toward him without you having to get there first, right? That's an important part of our God, which I think is pretty awesome. In the case of, that's what I discuss about that part of the Torah portion. I was the next few minutes just talk about Isaiah and Revelation really quickly. So Isaiah 29, which is read earlier by, I think it was Sam who read it, it discusses a somewhat similar thing, but God explains himself just a little bit, Isaiah 29, regarding what he was doing to Pharaoh, which I think is pretty cool. So God doesn't leave us hanging, trying to have us figure out what God was doing. He actually tells us what he was doing. So in the case what's that? He also asks, so God proud of himself, he had to explain what he was doing. Not exactly. God explains to us what he does on a regular basis. We just then realize, oh, if he does it all the time, he probably has always done that because God never changes. So in Isaiah 29, he explains what he's doing. There's a few things here. There's obvious connections to Pharaoh's dreams in verses 7 and 8 and such. But in the case, what I want to draw your particular attention to is verse 10 of Isaiah 29. For the Lord has poured upon, this is, he's talking about the people of their wise people of Jerusalem, has poured upon you a spirit of deep sleep. He has closed your eyes. He has covered the prophets and your chiefs, the seers. You and all the prophecy is like the words of a sealed document, which one gives to a literate person saying, please read this. He says, I cannot read, for it is sealed. That I was given to an illiterate person saying, please read this. His I am not literate. The Lord said, as much as his people has drawn close with its mouth and with its lips, has honored me, yet has distanced its heart from me. Their fear of me is like rote learning of a human command. Therefore, behold, I will continue to perform more wonders against the people, wonder upon wonder, wisdom of its wise men will be lost, understanding of its sages become concealed. So God is explaining to us that the methodology which he's talking to people, in this case, Pharaoh's wise men, he's blinding them. Even if they could explain all the Egyptian mythology to Pharaoh in minute detail and make it very convincing, even if they could figure out the seven years of good and bad, even if they could figure that part out, even if they were that smart, they may have been that smart at some point in time in their lives. God purposely was blinding them. They could not figure it out. Does that make sense? So we explain here, God actually blinds people, the prophets too can be blinded, in order to avoid from them explaining what he's doing, which is interesting. God will blind anybody if he has an objective. Not physical blind as far as mental blindness. You cannot understand what's happening. So we understand that God is capable of doing that and obviously does do that, and that he does it to man, but to also a lot of people. But it continues on as he explains that if he's blinding these individuals, verse 15, what are those who tried to hide in the depths to conceal counsel from Jehovah, and their deeds are done in darkness? They say, who sees us? Who knows us? Shall your contrariness be considered like the potter's clay? Can a pot product save its maker? He did not make me. Or a mold thing say to its molder, he does not understand me. Behold, in just a little while, the Lebanon will become farmland, and the farmland will be considered like a forest. On that day, the deaf will hear the words of a book, from the darkness and the blackness of the blackness of the eyes of the blind will see. The meek will increase their joy in Jehovah, and the poor among the people will rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. The fierce man is no more, and the scoffer is ceased to be, and all who strive for the iniquity will be cut off. Those who with a word cause man to sin and snare the one who gives rebuke at the city and mislead the righteous with falsehood. So he's pointing out that, hey, there's a point which I have blinded wise people. They don't understand. But there's also a point which I will open up the eyes of those who cannot see. and help those who hear who cannot comprehend. So he decides whose eyes are open, whose eyes are closed, which we all understand that. Even though we're dealing with pagan people at the time of Joseph and Pharaoh, he has blinded their once wise, whatever wisdom they think they have, he blinded the wisdom that they did have, and he opened the wisdom to Joseph. Now, there is no record of God whispering in Joseph's ear, "Hey, Joseph, 7 is 7 years." There's nothing of that. There's no record of God describing to Joseph what's happening. So maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Nobody knows. It's just it was just speculative guess. If you argue one way or the other, either way, Joseph did, however, explain what the symbols mean. So God did clearly open Joseph's either his mind, or he told him blatantly through his ear or his head. On we argue, but he opened his mind to understand what was being said or what the scripture was. So God opened a blind man's eyes. He's a dungeon, so to speak, and Joseph's eyes to his time in the dungeon as the lowest person essentially left in on earth to be elevated to the highest position possible, all in one day. The salvation came in a single day. It was quick. It was all very, very quick. So what we learn by this is that God, even though he has, oops, wrong button, push a button on my computer by mistake. God, even though he has the tools at his disposal to decide, hey, who's in charge, who's not in charge, who knows, who doesn't know, he also decides when they know and when they don't know. Does that make sense? The wise people of Pharaoh thought they were wise. I'm sure they were in certain ways, but they weren't wise enough in God's viewpoint at that moment in time. Joseph, who for all practical purposes would probably have abandoned God because he thinks God abandoned him, didn't. He stuck with him the whole time, even though most of us would probably cave. So in those instances, God said, hey, Joseph, you stuck with me. I'm going to open up your eyes, what you couldn't see. Now we learn later on Joseph's eyes were opened. More ways than just this, right? His brothers, he understood afterward, oh, God is the one who stole me down here, not you. I was sent down here to save everybody. All those things Joseph gets picture of what's happening. He doesn't get that along the way. Way back when he was dealing inside the pit and is yelling at his brothers, save me, save me, save me. Was he imagining himself, oh, wait, no, don't save me because I'm going to save you out of Egypt and I'll become king of Egypt, essentially, or just shy of king of Egypt. That's not part of God's explanation. It's intelligence ahead of time that that's what he's doing. So the wisdom of Joseph, he gets his eyes opened later on. Now, one thing I want to conclude here with is the book of Revelation, which was discussing this topic as well. I had mentioned, it would end with this passage here. I mentioned that in the case of Pharaoh's dreams, Pharaoh, of course, was in charge of the river. So Pharaoh was responsible for trying to fix a problem he didn't know how to fix. And God would not allow Pharaoh's wise men to explain it to him. He couldn't understand what they're supposed to do. Joseph explains, well, that being in charge of the river is not exclusive to Pharaoh. So in the book of Revelation, we have that example too, the tail end of that chapter of chapter 7. So the tail end of chapter 7, when the elders answered me, this is verse 13, who are these arrayed in white robes and where are they from? And I said to him, sir, you know. And so he says that these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation, washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits at the throne will dwell among them. Here's the part that I think is interesting. They shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them nor any heat. A lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living waters or fountains of waters. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So in this instance, we actually have a revelation picture or a pictorial example of what Pharaoh himself, their theology, believed. That Pharaoh was in charge of rivers, in charge of everybody's well-being, their hunger, their water. That was his task, his primary existence for purpose for existence was that job. And we have a revelation, well, Messiah is given that task. So essentially, Messiah is being given the job that Pharaoh imagines or their theology taught Pharaoh job was, or Messiah's, in fact, it's his job. It gives us this picture of a messianic figure, even though Pharaoh is not a very good messianic figure, per se, in his theology, but him being in charge of everything and God, our Father, giving him the authority to be in charge of all this stuff, being king, we have a repetition of the symbols in Pharaoh's dream and theology being repeated here in the book of Revelation chapter 7. That Messiah, you're in charge of the water. You're in charge of feeding, as Pharaoh was in charge of the Nile River and the feeding also of the people of Egypt. So we have this duplicate example that Messiah and Pharaoh are tied together in Pharaoh's dream, from his dream through Book of Revelation itself. And that tells us that Messiah and Pharaoh, with inside of Joseph's storyline, at this moment in time in the dream, that when Pharaoh had this dream, Messiah and Pharaoh are the same character, meaning that symbolically speaking, the same character. He has a responsibility to do something. Now he needs wise individuals to help him understand what he's supposed to do. And the people who are around him, those of us who are not so wise, like myself, spit out our ideas, but are not useful to him. In fact, we need somebody who is not like myself, who actually is wise, can actually explain what Messiah is supposed to do. That's the idea behind the symbolism and why all these different tribes, who are these different people who get robes and such, are all part of this storyline that God has granted Pharaoh his job in Egypt, and God has granted Messiah his job over these individuals and the rest of the earth. So that's kind of how I wanted to point this out to you, that God has the ability to, number one, talk to pagan people in their own language, right? That have to be our language to understand it. Number two, God can blind even wise people that are good in their own theology, their own pagan theology, can blind them. He can also open the eyes of those who he wishes to have opened. We already know that principle. And that Pharaoh, as well as Messiah, have the same task. Their job is to take care of the people that God gave them to take care of. All of us, that is. Those are the kind of principles I want to talk about, because I find it also, obviously, in tied into Joseph's story, his idea that, hey, he's also responsible to make faith-filled choices, as opposed to abandon God in his predicament of the dungeon he's hanging out here. We'll learn from the next Balances chapter how, in verse 38, Egyptian mythology or theology gets flipped on its head, and all of Pharaoh and all the storyline and all of Joseph gets all turned and flipped, and Pharaoh says, okay, Joseph, you're the guy for the job. Maybe we'll discuss that some other time, but actually Jeff covers it next week. So that's what I'm talking about. Any questions or comments regarding what our God is doing, the fact he can talk to pagans in a pagan culture, in a pagan belief, in a pagan language? He can also open their eyes or close their eyes with inside their language, so require them to walk to him. He can address them in their space. He can also talk to anybody else, for that matter, in that same context. I have any comments? Oops, Deborah. Sorry about that. My chat box for some reason closed out on me when I hit my computer by accident. So Deborah, you had a comment. Go ahead, Deborah. I apologize. I'm late for getting to it, but better late than never.
Pretty cool. Thank you. Okay. Tying this into Revelation from, you know, an opinion in the religious world from a lady that I find that she says, thus says the Lord. But right now, you know, in our political arena, because I can't attest to other countries, but in the United States, that these gods, those little gods, are now trying to take root up in the political arenas for these spiritual things that are happening right now, you know, with AI. And so we are right in the throngs, and not everybody can see it because it's spiritually discerned. And the media plays a giant role in what's happening today, as this scripture is, you know, because we're in these end times and now, however long they are. But I don't know who's having any dreams, but the spiritual aspects of what's going on right now is profound. And hearing you say this today, because I just listened to her this morning about, you know, I hate to say his name's Elon Musk, that and she coincides these dates when Hitler was born, that right now they're asking the Christian nations of people to be praying for our political people, because these spirits are trying to take root and control and cause history to take place. So it's so funny that you should talk about that, because that's right where my mind went, was is that we are in this and we are living this and seeing this happening right now before our very eyes of what's happening, which is not discerned by very many.
That's my story. It's an interesting perspective. So in general, I do realize, or do accept, I should say, that even though they are a host of Egyptian mythology gods, there's a host of Greek mythology gods, a host of Hindu mythology gods. Those mythology gods are not strictly pieces of paper with words written on them. I personally believe a number, I can't say how many, a number of them probably have, or at least majority of them have a demonic influence or demonic power behind them. That's my opinion. I realize that everybody has to agree with me, but that's my opinion. Some probably are just words of paper because they have a god that's called the god of crying. It's just dumb. It's called a baby. The picture is a baby. Okay, it's just Christ. A woman in menopause, okay? That might be. Some gods maybe just be got words on paper, but the point is some of these things they worship, they have attributes and features and whatever else they got going on. I do think that at least a large percentage, in my opinion, are demonic influence. And as a result, since all I have seen as far as what I can tell from the biblical text, very few, a very small number, at least one I can think of, actually had a god die. Meaning one of their demons die and did not return. So, and that was ordered by God himself because he's the one who can do that. So I think the majority of them are in fact not dead as far as like we think of dead, that they are still hanging around doing whatever they're doing. I don't know what it is, but I do think that they still are influencing either political world, nations or individual people. I know there's people who are demonically possessed. I'm not sure what kind of deity or thing that is. I'm not in that kind of a line of work. But the point is there's a lot of different weirdness happens. And it happens, it's probably has always happened. But we as our modern culture, being a Judeo-Christian principled nation within inside the United States and most, but not all, most of the European cultures, not nations, but cultures within inside the nations of Europe, have a Judeo-Christian principle baseline or stance they start with. But even within those baselines, there is plenty of room for demonic influence, alteration, tweaking. If I head in straight as an arrow, it doesn't take a lot of breeze to make the arrow just slightly drift to the left or slightly drift to the right. It doesn't take much to have it miss the target. So a demon can have a lot more power even over someone who thinks they're following the straight and narrow Judeo-Christian God. They can still be tweaked a little bit here or there and not realize it or notice it. It doesn't take a lot to do so because arrows have to fly pretty darn straight with a good wind, not going sideways in order to make them hit their target. So we have the same responsibilities. That includes leaders, whether it be a political leader, a financial leader, whatever. They all require a similar type of response. Household god of fermenting kimchi. You know what? They're probably, I would not be surprised there was. I'm sure there's a household god of fermenting kimchi. that would not shock me in any way. It's the time flies like an arrow, flies like a man. Yeah, exactly. So all these different things that influence the world around us, it can mess with our country, can mess with the world. But I don't believe it happens in a vacuum. I believe God is fully aware of it, and all the other demons are aware of what the other demons are doing. I think they're not ignorant of each other. Whether they like each other or hate each other, I think they still know what each other are doing. And that's my opinion, of course. But either way, a few of them ever have been killed. Amalek's demon, I think, is the only one that I know of that was wiped out. There may be others too, but that's one that comes to my head, at least thought my head at least. But either way, even if there is demon influence inside a person or a culture or a church or a synagogue or any kind of religious group, God still has me to talk to them. I think of, don't recall Balaam and the donkey. Well, Balaam, he believes in God, sort of, in his own version. And God said, okay, yeah, here's a donkey talk to you. Open your mouth, donkey's mouth to talk to you, right? To get the message. He can talk to you in the different ways and hopefully we listen. God obviously talked to Ruth. To bring Ruth back, bring Ruth the Moabite into Jerusalem, into Israel. God talked to Moses' father-in-law. He talked to through Jonah to the city of Nineveh. So God can talk to people even where they're at and even their pagan influence and still gear them in the right direction. I do trust he can do that. I don't know if he always will in every scenario, but as long as I am like Joseph as I can, I fear in reality, not in fake. I honor truth. And trusting him, and my heart clings close to him, regardless of what happens around me, I trust God will take care of me in that capacity. Any comments or questions?
When are you going to teach on the 1,000-year reign when we were at the Grange Hall? So I would please like to have, since time is nearing, since it was 13 years ago, if you would teach on the 1,000-year reign.
That's an interesting topic to discuss. It has a few verses pulled for the prophets for that section. I'll have to talk to Jeff about that, figure out what that looks like, because I don't know. Because we have fixed schedules we try to follow, so I'm not sure how that works. We'll discuss that when that may fit or not fit. Larry, you have a comment? Go on, Larry.
One thing that I have found very interesting is that there's evidence that, you remember that Ron guy that we went to watch his movies? He has evidence that that Joseph had a lot to do with actually inventing the symbolic language that the whole world uses now from hieroglyphics, because it happened at the same time that he was being an administrator to Egypt. And I think it's very interesting. You know, they have Proto-Hebrew is actually, you can trace it to the Hebrew, the Egyptian hieroglyphics, but they digitized it, or symbolic, made it symbolic, like our
made more symbol,
the alphabet, yeah.
Right. To pictograph, yeah, pictographical, right. Yeah. You're right, there is a pictographical transition that takes place, and I do recall reading somewhere, I forgot what it was, that somewhere around the 1700 BC or all the way through until like the 1400 BC, the phonetic alphabet was being refined or reworked or remodified, how we got the Phoenician stuff and everything else that came in the Greek and such. I find it interesting to me also, Larry, is that the language, the theology that Egyptians have, with their weird theology, it didn't stay in Egypt. So it looks like Plato, who spent a lot of time writing about Egyptian theology and bring it into the Greek mythology as well, as far as how the structure works. Egyptian, whatever happened in Egypt, essentially controlled most of the world for a very long time. And it's like that, as it was mentioned earlier in the prayer session, whether it was California, so goes to the United States. Well, at that time, whatever happened in Egypt, theological Plato, that's funny. Whatever happened in Egypt essentially controlled the world's religions. And which is really interesting as far as how you could watch the migration of religion and how it progressed from Egypt's mythology into other religions as the centuries go by. And Plato was a huge, huge factor in that, in the Greek mythology sequence of adopting the Greek mythology, the Egyptian mythology into their theology, which is, I would not surprise me at all, because obviously Plato and the Greeks thought Egyptians were super, super smart and brilliant people and tried to adopt what they could. It would not surprise me at all that other nations may have also thought similarly, that thought Egyptian was super, super smart, and which may have been a early progeny or early start of the phonetic alphabet that spread out through the Phoenician and other cultures. I don't know, though, because I don't know my history that well. Yes, Tammy, you have a comment about this?
I'm just looking for blog posts.
A blog post? I missed that.
Yeah, Deborah was looking for one of your old blog posts, and so I'm just searching for which one she might be talking about, because we do have over 15 years.
Yes, a lot.
Blog post.
I'm not.
Talks
I'm
from your really dad. Talks from you. Talks from Jeff. John Walsh.
Right.
We have a couple from Larry. We've got a lot of material, and so I'm just trying to go through and try to figure out which talk Deborah might be referring
I'm
to.
Not sure.
But I sent Jeff the link to one. But I really
because of all those blog posts, all those documentations, Jeff, myself, and all those men will never be allowed to run for political office. We're banned.
No joke.
We're just done, dead on the water. It's like, yeah. Oh, well. Any other comments or questions? If not, I'll turn this over to Jeff.
I was just going to say that that even if there's, and I'm not saying there's not, but even with demonic activity as far as politics and things in the world are concerned today, We need to treat it. I think it's important to treat it like the wheat and the tares. And the thing is that God allows deception to be revealed through processes like that, where, you know, we can go years and decades where people don't know the difference between who's doing what's right and who's not. And it can be really, really, really uncomfortable when we go through these processes like what we're dealing with in our country now. And the reality is that God uses those situations to shake us up and to reveal what the tares and who the tares are. And so even when we are aware of demonic activity and things like that, it's really important for us not to fear and to keep our focus on God and His Word, because God's doing that on purpose. What He's doing is He is actually showing people who may have been riding the fence which side they really need to stand on. And it's important for us to walk through these processes. So I just wanted to add that comment, because these things are for our good. They're not for our destruction.
Right. It would be of no value to tell someone that they're going to be destroyed if they aren't able to do something about it. They're not willing to try or not able to try. It's a wasted effort. So God is not in that business. Say demons are, but God's not in that business. I do find it, the example given I'm thinking of at least is the King Saul with the witch of Endor, and that God didn't tell him, you know, that he's going to die. The demon told him he was going to die. But it's of no value for God to tell you something that you can't do anything about. What good is it? If he's going to tell you something you can do anything about, great. If you can't do anything about, why would God do it? It's of no value to him or anybody else. It's useless. And so if you have demonic influence going on in a nation or people or whatever it may be, and you could do nothing about it, it's of no use to you. If you can do something about it, pray or whatever it may be that you can do about it, or seek restitution or somehow to fix or address it, then it is useful. Otherwise, it's only useful if we have some way of affecting and improving the outcome. Sam, you have a comment? Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah. I know there are different of opinion on the book of Revelation, that chapter 7. So I just want to hear your opinion on the omission of a tribe of Dan.
Oh, okay. To be fair, that's like a half hour long discussion, because I have a lot of opinions on that particular missing tribe. But in a short nutshell, and this is a very short nutshell, it's not quite, it's not complete by any means, but the biblical text is designed to use number 12 over and over and over again. It doesn't like using number 13, even though we know there are 13 tribes, because one tribe was split in half. So it can only use 12 because that's a symbolic term of 12. It means everybody, even though sometimes it's inclusive of all the tribes, sometimes it's not inclusive of the tribes. So there's a theme of 12 that has to go through in order to mean everyone. However, the fact that Dan was removed has been a lot of speculation. I read three different commentators about this particular subject matter a number of years ago about the historical migration of Dan, what they did and didn't do, where they bonded themselves to the Phoenicians for such a long period of time, and how many of them went over to Carthage and lived there before Rome just completely killed every human being alive in that space. So it's debatable as far as where Dan actually, like the tribe, why God eliminated them. Some have argued that they get eliminated because they no longer are observant or don't pay any more attention to or don't care about God or the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob anymore. I'm not inclined to think that, but I understand that's the argument that they're putting forward. My personal opinion, so even though Dan is not listed in that particular list of 144,000, I don't think he's excluded completely. In my personal Daniel Age's opinion, is that in the innumerable multitude that are outside those tribes, they still get inclusive of a whole host of different kinds of people. And here's the weakness. Here's the hard part of trying to rectify Revelation's list of all those different tribes with the lists we have of the actual biological tribes. So Dan has a specific territory granted to him, actually two, in Israel's, the nation Israel proper. There's a northern section and the southern section where Samson lived. They had two in parts that belonged to the nation of Dan. If God eliminates one of those descendants or wipes out Dan completely, for example, then those two inherited spaces are not allowed to change tribes. You don't get to switch them. We'll just dig them up. It doesn't work that way. God said, you can only the biological male descendants can inherit a territory land. So you can't divvy up land without biological male descendants. So those men, the Midian, need to be around somewhere, else they cannot inherit the promises that God gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God is not in the habit, I mean, he even saved Benjamin from extinction through the whole, the Ephrath and all that stuff, the slaughter that took place during the group of judges, saved them to preserve that tribe. Dan, I think, is preserved somewhere. I don't have an answer why he's missing from that list, but I don't think he's supposed to be missing. Because in the form of the 12 God uses number 12 for a reason. Sometimes he eliminates Levi off the list. Sometimes he eliminates or combines Manasseh and Ephraim from the list. I don't think it's a fixed, hard list. That's my opinion. I think actually it's more flexible than that. That's my opinion. I think the actual list is the 144,000 that he listed there is supposed to be inclusive of these people. If you actually calculate out 144,000 human beings, that's practically nothing. That's almost nothing. There are millions that exist from those tribes. Millions who are obedient to God, far more than 144,000. You look at them. You have millions of people who are biological descendants of the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, part of those tribes that are obedient to God's word. And so I'm not inclined to think the 144,000 is a fixed hard number. This is my opinion, of course, but rather it is a symbolic number, meaning everybody. But that's my opinion only. I don't think Dan is actually being removed. I think it's probably an inclusive of that time period while that list was being written, that no one knew where Dan was. And that is true. At the time period which the revelation was being written, the tribe of Dan was completely lost to history, meaning no one knew where that tribe went. The other tribes, they do have records of where they were at the time which the revelation was written, but Dan's tribe's record was missing. So no one knew where they were. That may have been why the vision doesn't include them, but I can't explain wholly as to why. It's a really complicated and very touchy and highly opinionated topic to discuss. So that's a short nutshell comment. Sorry, there's a lot more to it than just that, but I can't get into all of it. Take too much. I have a few books on that topic, but I'm not going to go through all of them today. So I apologize. Maybe if we're in person, I'd be able to talk to you more privately about it.
And Deborah has one little comment. Anyway, you know, in the Torah portion where Moses is not in there, there was a Torah portion, perhaps like Dan, that, you know, remember he took Moses out and didn't let him go into the promised land, but we can't assume that that means he's not, because, you know, the Hebrew or the Jewish teaching is that he was not in that Torah portion for some reason. Perhaps like with Dan, you know, the scenario is that not in that, in the book Revelations, where because we have the templates and it repeats itself, perhaps Dan's not in there like the Moses scenario, perhaps.
It totally could be. That is actually one of my Jewish commentary books, which is not Christian, actually talks about that. Because even though Jews don't believe in the Revelation story, they aren't ignorant of what the New Testament says. They do talk about it too. They talk about Dan missing, and their argument was, well, it does not mean that Dan isn't saved, isn't in heaven. It just means that it's not listed that particular list for a different reason, and they argue what that reason is. But that's kind of where that where I tend to agree with that philosophy. I think God is intended to wipe out a tribe without a really, really good reason. He did it for Amalek. I get why he wiped out Amalek, in the book of Exodus, or actually the kings did it. But that was a specific reason, and I don't think, I could be wrong, I don't think Dan is as evil as, or became as evil as Amalek was. So if God waited to Amalek to be that level of evil before he wiped them out, I don't think he would. I don't think Dan ever reached that level. So I'm not inclined to think God said we'll just wipe out Dan too. I don't think he's that kind of person or being. Yes, Pat. I know I'm getting over time here, guys. So Pat,
your last comment. Real quick, after the 12 tribes that they mentioned, he said, "Behold, a great multitude which no man could number of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues stood before the throne." In other words, God included, it just, he listed those first 144,000. But then after that, it shows where God included all of us who are believers.
He does. He does. I don't think he lets us go. Because he's not, at least not that easily. Maybe sometimes we're hell bent on destruction, but doesn't let us go that easily.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.